Welcome to the Addy Hour, where we talk brain science, mental health, faith, culture, and social justice.
Having attended one of Dr. Addy's town halls, I can tell you that it's vital information for anyone living in America right now.
It was the first time in a very, very long time where I felt like all of me could show up, each parts of my identity.
I'm your host, Dr. Nee Addy.
My friend, Dr. Nee Addy, is such a unique person who is both scientifically astute, understands the human soul and the mind. At the same time, he has compassion and empathy for the masses. He's been nothing but a blessing to my congregations and my friends.
It was the first time I felt like it was safe to talk about issues that are usually not talked about, like mental health and faith and wrestling with your identity. By the end, I walked out feeling so much more validated and hopeful.
Well, welcome back to another episode of the Addy Hour. I know we've had a little bit of a slower cadence recently, but for good reason, as I've been working on a book. And I'll have more info about that soon, but I think this conversation is definitely going to be worth the wait, as you all are going to hear from a unique and talented individual. I'm not going to give any spoilers as we jump in, but really glad to have Sho Baraka join on the podcast today. I'm calling this something like Culture, Vocation, and Calling, but I anticipate that we might have to rename it after this conversation. We'll see where things go, but I want to go ahead and welcome Sho Baraka to the Addy Hour podcast.
Yes. Hey, thank you for having me, doctor. Expectations really low, but really broad as well. So
I think that's well said. So it's my pleasure to introduce Amisho Sho Baraka, who is a self-described polymath. For those who don't know what that is, a person of wide-ranging knowledge or learning. He spent the last 17 years traveling the world as a recording artist, consultant, speaker, and writer. He has 4 solo albums, 3 feature film appearances, and 1 book to his name. He saw that it was good. Whether he's operating as a creative implementer or as a solutionary, that's a word I think he made up, Sho is wisely discerning the times while attempting to bring restoration and redemption. He's the co-founder of the AND campaign and a founding member of the internationally known hip-hop consortium, the 116 Click, and the record label Reach Records. He's also served as a visiting professor at Wake Forest University and at Warner Pacific University. He's currently working with My Boulevard to build a community called Good Culture. And basically, this is a space that will galvanize cultivators around story, arts, and ideas. Sho lives in Atlanta, Georgia with his wife, Patrice, his wife of 21 years, and their 3 children. Sho and Patrice also have 2 boys on the autism spectrum. And so these days, they find themselves as ambassadors and advocates in the autism community. So again, a lot there and a little bit of space, something that's really powerful just reading your bio, but knowing all the things that you've been about over the years, the things you're about, and definitely appreciate you taking the time to be on this podcast and to talk about all these different topics, and we'll see where things go.
I mean, thank you for having me. I find it a privilege. So yeah, let's see.
Awesome. Well, my listeners know, you know, I usually like to just jump in with a check-in question just to see how folks are doing. I mean, I feel like there's so many things that we can talk about just from your bio itself, but just wanted to start and see how you're doing at this point in time. I know you're juggling a lot today, so anything you want to give us in terms of insights and just your daily navigation?
Yeah. So, you know, we do check-ins at my job, and sometimes I try to do them with my family when my family's not utterly disgusted with me. But and usually what we do is we go through the 8 emotions. We say, hey, out of these 8 emotions, how are you feeling? And so for me right now, I think that I'm feeling glad, but I also feel a little bit of shame, if you will. So glad because I'm excited about where my marriage is, where my family is. But shame, there's something about my vocation right now that's I'm just not excited about. And I'm trying to figure out how not to make those, or not to allow those particular emotions go to the shadow, but operate in the gold, not, you know. So the impaired versions, as some people call it, of sadness and shame versus, I guess you can say, the benefit of what do we do now that we know that we feel this way. So that's why I think that's the best summation of where I am.
That's, well, one, I mean, I say this a lot, but I just appreciate the level of honesty and vulnerability. And also just knowing you, I mean, this might sound a little bit funny, but I also appreciate your, the skill set, I guess I would call it, that you've developed. I mean, as, even as you talked about how you do that as a family, you do that at your workplace, like that's not new territory to you. And I feel like that in and of itself is also something to be applauded. And the fact that you can kind of actually hold those two, because so much of what we talk about on this podcast, what we talk about in society is just the importance of being able to go to that place. And I'm also impressed that you're able to get to that pretty quickly. Not that that solved everything, because you still have that tension, but the fact that you're able to kind of verbalize that and to use that to kind of navigate through, I think is really to be applauded. So I appreciate you going to that space.
It'll all be solved when you release that book. So hurry up, sir.
My goodness. I'm gracious or grateful just for the opportunity for that book. And I feel like God's kind of placed that in my heart. But every time I have a conversation on some of the topics in the book, people are like, I need that now. Yeah. I can't wait to read that. So
absolutely.
Now I'm going to keep the listeners waiting since it comes out May of 25, but it's coming. But just, I mean, there's so many questions that come to mind, but one, just kind of initially thinking about, like, how did you get to a place of being able to describe all that so clearly? Because I'm imagining, I'm speculating here, but I'm imagining that's not something that you grew up being able to do. This is not like a day one. You've always been this person who can kind of verbalize emotions on the spot like that. Like, how did that come about?
Through a series of being a toxic individual and thinking that I was very healthy, displaying behaviors. You know, I have a buddy who is I forget what he's a PhD in. He just got it, so that's the reason why I'm not sure. But fair. he often talks about emotions, and he says the only emotion that men are able to allow to share is anger. You know, and oftentimes, you know, when we're feeling other emotions, what we do is we just jump right straight to anger, and we think like, you know, no, deal with the shame, deal with the loneliness. These things are fine. You just got to figure out how do we operate in that. And for me, I just never knew how to deal with my anxiety. I never knew how to deal with the rejection that I was feeling. And it would always turn into, well, I just got to perform better. I just got to do better. I just got to be better. And through through the terrorizing of relationships that were important to me, and through failures in my own life, I realized, man, I need help. I need assistance. And you know this about me, I'm a man of deep faith. And oftentimes when you come through communities of faith, counseling is not something that is heralded. Mm-hmm. And so for much of my life, I thought, well, I'll just pray it away, or I'll read it away, or I'll think it away, you know, and not just in a spiritual sense. Well, I'm an educated man, I think. So let me read it away in some sort of way. What are the things? Or you get real practical. Well, just stop doing it. Stop feeling this way, you know. And none of those things were working. And it's like, well, maybe I just don't have the right tools. Maybe I don't have the right resources. And I have friends who, some books back here, friends you know of, people who, and some just thoughtful individuals who wrote books, and that led me to say, you know what, maybe I need help that is professional. And it have often been shunned upon, especially within Black spaces.
Yeah, that's really powerful. I mean, as I'm listening to you talk to, I'm also anticipating that there's probably some resistance there too, either like internally in yourself, or maybe in other people that you are encountering. Cause it seems like people will, cause even I'm thinking about the word shame that you use, like how often do I hear, I'm just going to make it really specific, how often do I hear Black men talking about shame?
Yeah.
Unless, but the fact that you could go there. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. I was going to just make a joke. That's my go-to is when I don't really have anything to say, is make a joke. I think, you know, I don't like to make create anecdotes out of I don't like to make a doctrine out of anecdotes, but for the most part, I will say, through my experience, I don't think many of the people that I will, that I existed around or orbited around encouraged therapy, counseling, just the practice of being mentally healthy. And I'll say this, not only did they not encourage that, they almost in some ways encourage you to not only not seek professional help, but there's a subtle practice within some of the spaces that I existed in that almost encourage you to destroy other people's mental health, to perpetuate the idea of like destroying or tearing down people, whether that do that be through jokes, whether that be through public shaming, bullying, whether that be through music, or visual arts. You know, I think about me as a hip hop artist growing up, most of hip hop is, for many reasons and some really good, it's a very demonstrative art. It's a very, it proclaims great thoughts, ideas, and makes a great declaration, while at the same time, it can also be very demonstrative, or it can be very dangerous in tearing down the psyche of an individual. We're always trying to be competitive and achieve more than the next person, and also let you know how, you know, how poor your quality, the quality of your music is while building myself up. Right. And so think about, man, a teenager, think about, well, not even an adolescent, a teenager, a young adult, an adult wrestling with all these signals intruding him. And then you come to this point of where you realize, well, I know that Jesus tells me to love my enemy, and he tells me to think highly of not only myself, but others around me. But I'm struggling with the cultural signals that are being passed to me as well. And so you got to figure out what dog's going to eat, you know, because you know, you got to starve one and feed the other.
And you opened up so many, trying to decide where I went, because there's so many topics there that you just peeled back the layers on. And I know you also, you know, taught classes on the intersection of hip hop, politics, and faith. And so that whole narrative isn't the best word, but that whole kind of persona within hip hop, I'm thinking about, you know, battle rap, all the other pieces, where I think the whole intent is bravado and kind of building yourself up, diminishing the other person. Whether that's based on reality, whether that's based on a caricature. I mean, there's larger conversations we could have about, you know, the state of hip hop. But I'm also thinking about how that gets reflected in the culture in general. I'm thinking about things like politics. I'm thinking about just all of us operating on a day-to-day basis. Like, are we operating in who we are as our authentic selves? Or is there this aspect of what we have to show people? I mean, there's also hip hop and social media, so... This is not a well-formulated question, but I'm curious, just any thoughts you have on any of that.
Look, if this was just a conversation, I think we can talk for hours just around the things you know, the propositions you just threw out there. One is hip-hop has provided great tools for young people, especially young Black people, or young people of color as well. And that it definitely gives you a confidence that is otherworldly, you know. It gives you a like an almost like an eschatology, if you will, of how to see the world not as it is right now, but as you hope it to be. So, I am an artist.
Break down eschatology for folks. Just to
It's a way to see the end, like the end of the world, or the see the evolution of the world. It's a religious term of like end times, how we see a time after in which Jesus came and the advent. But how do we see the world evolving and the church being integrated within this new world after? And so I think hip hop does a good job of giving a world to people, even though hip hop does a great job of helping people see the world, not necessarily as it is right now, but as it could potentially be. Right. And so an artist will say, you know, he'll talk about the cars he has. He talks about the girls he gets. He talks about the, you know, the business deals he possesses. While all in real life, he probably has none of that. you know. But in some ways, it's almost like a self-fulfilled prophecy, because although he doesn't have that now, if he continues to grind and work hard and have that confidence that I spoke about earlier, maybe he will achieve that, or she will achieve those things. However, in that, the one dangerous tool that hip hop also has is that it seems as if in order for me to be successful, other people can't. Now, this is not across the board. And so in that they can't, what tends to happen is, I think you find that people are, you know, tearing other artists down, or they, it becomes a rivalry in which, you mentioned battle rap. Like, I have to, it's a scarcity. I'll just say it like this. It's a scarcity mindset where there's not enough good for all of us. And oftentimes that is very dangerous. And if we can see why that is, and I'm getting out of my expertise here, but we think about gang culture, we think about how hip hop was cultivated in the 70s, but think about these neighborhoods that were blighted and had scarce resources. And so you have these organizations, you have these people who are trying to do good, and maybe they're starting as service groups and they're trying to provide resources to particular people, and then those resources become gold, if you will. And so those groups begin to fight over those resources, and then it no longer becomes about the resources, it becomes the conflict, right? Mm-hmm. The conflict is the fuel for which we live and move and have our being now. And so out of that, you have these group of people who are fighting over resources in this blighted community. And then hip hop comes to say, hey, how can we galvanize you guys to give you something that you can all like unify around? And so now you want to show which borough, which group within the borough is the best in representing that. And so it's just it's like a tentacle that spreads it spreads across different types of cultures, and it still has that ethic that may be a little dangerous, while at the same time presenting people with opportunities to thrive. And so, yeah, I think that's one. I totally forgot the other parts of the question. So
that's because it was too big.
But yeah, I mean, so that's
everything you highlighted. I mean, I'm thinking just about like the benefits and the consequences. Maybe consequences isn't the right word. But just like the importance of community too, because everything that you've talked about in communities that were intentionally deprived, I'll just say it that way, and to have something to rally around, but then where does that ultimately lead? And then just even looping back to what you were talking about from the mental health standpoint too, like there's no benefit, apparent benefit, to showing weakness or acknowledging shame or all those types of things. So, I mean, granted, things have moved. People are talking about that more, but there still seems to be this, I'm getting too academic, but like a dissociation or a difference between what people are willing to say they're going through versus when it comes down to it and they're really in the middle of something, whether that be like a mental health struggle or something else, to really own up to it and say like, this is too hard for me. And it seems like that is, for so many of us, for so many different reasons, it's just a hard layer to get beneath. I don't know if I'll switch gears a little bit, but if you've even seen that as you've been teaching classes at different universities at different points in time, like what you've seen in your students coming into the class, if that seems to also be present in them as well.
You know, I honestly don't think so. I think the generation of students that I've taught, I find that they are very open. Even some of the men are very open and authentic and honest about their, I guess you could say, fragility or their brokenness, and how they emote health. Now, what I will say, maybe, because with every gift, there is a shadow, or whatever, with all gold, there's a shadow. I will say previous generations, they had a stick-to-itness. They had an endurance, a resilience that was unprecedented, but it lacked an emotional IQ, right? Well, I will say today, I think a lot of the youth are emotionally, for the most part, folks that I've observed, they're emotional aware, but they may be a little too sensitive at times to where now it's like they're extremely fragile. And just by simply saying, hey, that assignment just wasn't good, you know, that was poor writing, It's like, okay, now I got to talk to a mother because I got to have a, like, we got to have a counseling session. And so it's like, okay, like, I don't know how to critique, you know? So I will say there's the goat and the shadow to generation, but I will say, yeah, I think they're aware, more aware than I was, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good point. I think it's still a tension at the same time.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking, like, generationally. So I'm thinking, yeah, this was like 2 or 3 years back when Michael Eric Dyson was on the podcast and him talking about his generation and just the grind that they were on fighting all the social justice issues and not being able to take a step back. And so hearing him acknowledge, okay, maybe we need to actually pay attention and take a pause at some point, even though the things that were at risk were so large and so weighty in a lot of ways. But hearing him kind of articulate that tension, and then at the same time, thinking about the question that I always get asked when it comes to just thinking about anxiety, for instance. So people will say, okay, if we're thinking about younger generations, is anxiety more prevalent? Are we seeing it more often? Are mental health challenges more prevalent and more common? Or are we just paying better attention to them and they were always there in the first place? Or is it both? And so I always say, it always seems to me to be a little bit of both, but I'm curious your take on that.
Well, I want to answer the question, and I also want to pose a question to you because you know, I've read and listened to, you know, Jonathan Haidt. He recently released a book, and he's talking about how social media has impacted, you know, mental health. And the one thing that I can say that I've noticed, without doing any extensive research, but just the personal anecdotes within my own life and friends around me, I think it has affected us recently. It's more prevalent than maybe generations before because of the ubiquitousness of the ubiquitous nature of our platforms, how everybody has an opportunity to speak to issues. And the reason why I think the activist kind of ethic, the activist culture that is prevalent within society makes us feel this need to always be present, to consistently speak to issues, even if we're not experts on it. And that to me is very dangerous. And you have a person who's popular for music like myself, but I've written songs about political issues and people were, man, I love your voice. I love what you have to say about issues, man. I love this song about injustice and, you know, and education. I love this song about racism. And so all of a sudden, you know, Israel Palestine pops up and then people are like, hey, show, what do you think? What's your, and I'm like, I have no idea, but I feel the pressure to have to say something because the people depend on me. And even when people don't depend on us, we still feel the pressure. Nobody's checking for you, Sam, to speak on this issue, but yet you feel like you have to speak to it. And so both of us have to have the discipline to know, like, yes, there was a time where we probably could have used more people to speak up on issues, whether it be in our houses, communities, especially within the political space, in media, but today I don't think we're in need of people to speak up. If anything, I think we're in need of less people to speak up and allow professionals to speak. However, still challenge, to still critique, still evaluate truth, the fact, truth, and everything else. But that's been my struggle. And, you know, there are, and so I guess I will ask you, what are your thoughts about social media? And I know this is not your area of expertise, but you are way more qualified than you're the most qualified person on this call to have this conversation. What are your thoughts around the mental health impact of social media and how we engage it when it is more specifically when it comes to issues of tragedy or situations of tragedy?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm going to answer the question differently than I have in the past, just from some of my observations, I'll say, over the last few weeks, just different events I've been involved in. And especially as a neuroscientist and mental health advocate, so much, and this is not to minimize mental health to one specific aspect, because there are lots of different situations that can put people into a challenging mental health state. But so much of what people navigate, if we're not talking about serious mental health in terms of different experiences, often has to do with mindset. So if someone's really anxious about something, there could be lots of reasons that led to that. The silly example I always give is like, if you had a really bad, not silly, but if you had a really bad experience in the elevator that almost crashed to the ground, you're going to think about that every time you get into an elevator again, whether or not that next elevator has any safety concerns whatsoever. And so I guess the antidote here is just in terms of social media. If you have this expectation, this mentality, you can get yourself easily stuck in a mentality that's not based on reality whatsoever. And that can wreak havoc on people's perspective and how they go about things. I mean, it actually loops back to the example you were talking about, just even in terms of the social justice pieces. So many students that I was interacting with in the middle of the pandemic who were appropriately trying to put out fires in their own lives, everything that was happening on a global scale, but not always taking time to step back, like going 1,000 miles an hour, feeling like every fire that came up, they had to put out, and then getting stuck in a place of just being drained, being burnt out. Whereas not that it was easy, but just a little bit of a shift in the mentality could actually help people step back from that and be like, okay, I need to actually take time to rest. It didn't change the external situation, but perspective changed. And so when I think about, again, it's not based on research, when I think about mentality, social media, and the mindset that it puts us in, sometimes we're just having unnecessary mental weight for something that doesn't need to be that weighty. And that's not to say that there aren't other things that happen. There's general anxiety. There's so many things people navigate, but that's a layer of it at the same time.
And so here's, and I'm going to throw this out here, and I would love for your thoughts. I think part of the problem is we don't localize our tragedies. Our tragedies are global now.
Yeah.
And granted, I love the fact that social media gives us the opportunity to advocate for people and issues that are miles away. However, I don't think our brains or that our human experiences were set up to care about, or not to care about, that's a bad word.
to
hold on to things that we probably have no real impact on or changing in life. And so because, and I've sensed this in my own life, because I'm always chasing tragedy everywhere around the world, the things that are happening locally aren't as important because one, there's not a big applause for those, you know, to remedy those issues. But then two, maybe a fist fight that breaks out on my street is not as important as a police shooting in Minnesota. And so therefore I'm going to ignore, and I think it's kind of minimize what tragedy is in our paradigm. And so for me, we have to reconstruct what evil is and make it more localized by always just trying to see what's social media? What's the news outlet that I'm following? What's the thing that they're trying to get me to care about today? Rather than just being concerned with, is Ms. Johnson able to get to the grocery store right now because they've shut down public transportation? You know, these are the things that I'm trying to reconcile in my own life.
I think that's really important. I mean, you mentioned the brain perspective too, but there's layers to that too, because even, I mean, other people who've come on the podcast, we've talked about just the impact of just scrolling, watching videos of tragedy after tragedy, the impact that can have on us, on our brains, the impact it can have on us psychologically. Then even, you know, I've cited this work a lot, but David Williams talking about the impact on Black and brown communities if someone in that state who's unarmed has been shot by police and killed. And that has negative mental health consequences on individuals in those communities. So that's also reality. But then also knowing how much to pay attention to, how much to pull back. And then just thinking about globally what's happening in different parts of the world, and also different ways that people perceive things outside of our Western culture. I mean, talking to people I know that have grown up in different parts of the world where tragedies, unfortunately, were just so commonplace that they didn't feel like it impacted them the same way. That's not to say it wasn't impacting them, wasn't having an impact on their brain, but perspective going through that. And then on the flip side, just thinking about the way that we've been designed and created to actually thrive in community, like actually being altruistic to someone else, that local person who needs help, that will actually positively impact people's brains. It will actually bring about empathy. It can actually have. So, I mean, I think it's on both sides. And I think your call, in a sense, to remind us of what's happening in our community in front of us and not to ignore that is really important as well. And actually impacts our mental health as well.
Yeah, man.
So I also want to loop back, because as I was going through your bio, one question that I had, which we've touched on, is, you know, this thought of the polymath. So again, definitely, you know, a person of wide ranging knowledge and learning.
Yeah.
What, and you've already alluded to this, but what's the balance for someone who carries himself that way to say, okay, this is something I don't want to use the word qualified per se, but this is something I'm going to speak on, and this is something where I'm going to step back. Like, how do you, and I'm making this too broad, but I'm even thinking about, we'll come back to your tension about vocation too, because I feel like that's all wrapped into part of this too.
Yeah.
How do you find that balance?
This is the shame. This is the shame I'm dealing with right here. It's like that. I often feel like I oftentimes think of myself as a vocational nomad. Like I struggle to stay situated in one particular field of interest for too long. And I think that's both a blessing, but I also think it could be something of like anxiety inducing, if you will, because when I'm writing music, I'm just so excited about writing music or writing musicals. And then there's a moment where I'm like, you know what? I really want to work in writing stories. I want to write short stories or write a memoir or something like that. And then I'm fully into that. And then it's like, you know what? I want to do something with my hands. I want to do woodworking or carpentry. And, you know, the beauty is that it makes me a well-rounded person and it teaches me a lot about life. It gives me diversity in how I can be employed or how I can make money. But the tension in that is that it does also create a lot of feast and famine moments in my life. It oftentimes also creates the tension of what you're saying, the illusion that I could be an expert in an area of expertise, but I'm not quite, you know. And so therefore there are moments where I probably should pursue this a little bit more and focus on this a little bit more versus, and I think for me, I have to just have honest introspective thoughts of like, show, when are you performing for people? When are you performing for yourself? Or when are you actually performing out of the abundance of your heart and love for the Lord or for the well-being of other people? Not just performing for applause, but when are you performing because you truly believe like this is the best work for the current situation? Now let me go on a quick tirade. So one of the things that I like to do is I teach about calling from a biblical perspective this is my own particular assessment of what calling means. When someone says, hey man, I feel called to this. I think, you know, throughout the Bible, you'll see three different areas of which God calls people. And he calls people according to skill, which is very, you know, common. You know, a Samson is a very strong individual. He's like, hey, I need you to go fight. Or somebody who's a skilled fighter, you know, go do this. Or, Then you have other folks who are, there's a Bezalel is in the scriptures in Exodus. He talks about, he called him to craft instruments and temples and things of that nature. But then you have people who are called according to a need. Like there's a particular need that is out there, but they may not be skilled necessarily at it. But he's like, hey, Moses, I need you to go free my people. And Moses is like, I don't think I'm qualified for this. But yet still, he says, I didn't ask you if you're qualified. There's a need to be addressed. Same thing with Gideon. You know, Gideon, and there's many people who just don't feel necessarily qualified, but there's a need. And then the last thing, this is the thing that no one really wants to deal with. He calls us according to suffering or through a teachable moment. Mm-hmm. And Paul is a great example of this, you know, go and preach the gospel and I will show them how much he will suffer for my cause. Jesus, in a sense, is called to suffer for the sake of humanity. And so when I think about what I do in life, I try to say, man, in which area am I operating in? Because sometimes I'm operating according to the thing I'm extremely skilled in. But then sometimes I may spend a few months or a few weeks working on something that is just a need. For instance, I am a part of a church, and that church had a second campus, and the campus started to fall apart because the pastors left. And they said, show, you're a good communicator. We think you're a good leader. At least you play one on TV. So why don't you go and just for a time period, help just restore life to this church. I had no desire to be a pastor. Zero desire to be a pastor. I didn't even think I would be a good pastor, doctor. But, you know, I said, you know what? There's a need here. Mm-hmm. And I have capacity. So I'll do it, you know. Mm. And I enjoyed it, man. I loved it. Mm. I actually loved it. I love that now. If I probably would have stayed longer. Yeah, I don't know. You know what? I maybe was lying to myself that I didn't want to be. But, you know, here's the thing. I love people. Mm-hmm. I love to create community. And I love to communicate. I love teaching. So you would think that a person who loves those things would love to pastor. I think what I don't like is the bureaucracy around.
Yeah.
I don't like meetings. I do. I hate meetings. I hate talking about things that I think we could resolve through email. Mm-hmm. I'm an ideator too. So if as long as the meeting's around ideation, oh, mm-hmm. let's do it. The moment we get to the implementation, I'm like, all right, somebody else can. Who are you going? You know? So, yeah. So suffering or according to a situation or a need. And so that's, you know, I find myself operating in different, I guess you can say, areas of calling at different times in my life. And I oftentimes find myself enjoying it when I am operating and when I think I'm operating mm-hmm. in the right spirit. And
That's really helpful. You kind of hear your journey in that too, like again, in real time, even with that tension too. I'm curious, you know, for someone who's listening and also feeling like either if they're in school in some shape or form or in a job or just trying to figure out like vocation and calling, if these things match, how much weight do you think people should put on having a sense of calling while they're going about that work? Because some would argue that even having that conversation or thought process is a place of privilege. Like not everybody gets to think through. So like how would you advise someone in any of those types of situations?
Yeah. And so this, and I think the three dynamics that I presented, in some ways I would like to think removes that privilege. Mm. And here's why, is because oftentimes, I mean, you said it, oftentimes when I've been in spaces, especially religious spaces, where we've had discussions around, let's just say, a theology of calling or a doctrine mm-hmm. around calling, work, faith, ethics, things like that. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes those conversations can become quite elitist. Mm. You at Yale, you wouldn't know anything about that. So what happens is you only are talking to the people who can pursue careers, right? Mm-hmm. People who know if I pursue this, I can build up, you know, a portfolio, get 401k. Here's my goal. Eventually I'll, you know, retire. I'll be good by the time I turn 55 or 60, you know. But, you know, my mom didn't really have that luxury. Now, would she have loved to have that? Great. So the luxury she had is, there's a need in front of me. I got to figure out how to provide for this mm-hmm. family, because the need, the immediate need right now is to make sure my family can eat. Mm-hmm. So there's ways of taking that need from just like, hey, MLK saw a need. Mm-hmm. He saw that there was great injustice. And he said, I have the ability to speak to this. Or others saw that he had the ability. And they said, hey, we would love for you to join this particular movement to speak to this issue. Other people throughout history have used their platform to speak to a need. But that's we can even in some ways see that as an elitist way of approaching calling. But, you know, sometimes our parents are fulfilling the base level needs that we have as humans to just eat, live, and be merry. You know what I'm saying? And so I would say to those folks listening, you can still pursue your academic goals, your dreams, aspire to have this particular vocation. But I would say just be sensitive to what needs may be around you, what you may have to suffer in order to not only become the best version of you, but to provide, you know, the best life for other people. I think when you think about civil rights activism throughout history, these are people who said, I see how much I'm going to have to suffer in order to provide a better life for other individuals. And yet they still took on that calling. To me, that is a great testament of what vocation can do. And here's the other thing that I would say. Your job, I don't think your job has to be tied to some social good in order for it to be meaningful. The fact that you work in itself is, I think, meaning is beautiful. And if I would even go to get a little spiritual, I would say that it's worship as unto the Lord. The job itself isn't worship. The act of cultivating is worship. When we see in Genesis, and here's my issue with a lot of the gospel that's taught in a lot of our churches, we only talk about a personal relationship with God. Well, if all I care about, and if God only cares about my personal relationship with him, then I'm allowed to create an earthly hell with things I do, as long as I feel like my piety is good. But that's not how God instituted relationships. He instituted a relationship with us. He instituted a relationship with us understanding who we are within ourselves. Mental health, right? This is where individuals like you come in. But he also instituted a relationship with one another. How do we relate? But the fourth area in which I think is important, he instituted a relationship on how we work and how we cultivate and how we deal with the land. And what we believe as Christians, we believe that sin violated all four of those major relationships. And what Jesus does is he restores that. And so it's not just about my personal piety. It's about how I relate to God through the redemptive work of Jesus, but also how I redeem the relationship with others, how I redeem the relationship with myself, and how I work. And so as you are thinking about the way you work, think about how what you do impacts those folks around you.
That's good. Folks are going to have to play that back too, because I think there's so much, just one of the pieces that you mentioned, just the pressure to be like, whatever I'm doing on day-to-day has to have this huge social I love what you said about just all the aspects of community too. So I just wanted to also actually tie that back in to something that again was in your bio, just to lead off as we kind of wrap up, but just thinking about neurodiversity too. Obviously you have a personal investment in that, as you and your wife, you know, are advocates for autism community, with the family scenario you have with both of your boys, but then also just thinking about like local community and that awareness, because I think there has been a big push now for people to have appreciation for who are we as a community. And when we see people interacting, acting in different kinds of ways, do we make assumptions or do we actually have a heart of compassion to say, okay, I might not actually know what this person's experience is, and that includes things like neurodiversity, but to be able to kind of change our perspective and have that awareness. So obviously for you, that's been a personal journey, but I'm curious how that journey continues for you as a family and how you've also sought to raise awareness for others who maybe were unintentionally oblivious to those things in the past.
That's a great question. There's a few things that I've done and I continue to do. One is I try to partner with organizations who are creating that said diversity, whether it be in zoos, in arenas, restaurants, helping churches to create spaces that make it suitable for people who may have, who may fall on the wide spectrum of sensory sensitivities, if you will. And so in doing that, there are different things. Like one, are we considering training people? I'm sure we've all been on airports where, or we've all been on an airplane and you've heard babies cry, or you've heard like someone who may seem like they're on the spectrum just get anxious and agitated. And there are different organizations out there who are just doing their best to try to train flight attendants, you know, waiters, waitresses, police officers, people who work in just public venues on how to interact with people who are neurodivergent. The other thing I do is I write music. I remember the first time I became an advocate, if you will, was actually by accident. There was a gentleman who was doing interviews with hip hop artists about parenting. And he asked me, he said, what is it like to be in hip hop and also be a parent, which should be something that people talk about, but obviously we don't have I'm pretty sure we don't have more than a dozen songs out there about parenting. It just, so anyway, I start to talk about it, but I also mentioned, because around that time I realized that our son was on the spectrum. We had got an official diagnosis and he didn't know this. He was shocked. And I was just kind of spilling about it. And I just got to talking about it. And so he posted it. And then people start reaching out to me, just asking me for insight. And like, man, thank you. I'm struggling with the same thing. And are there resources? And at the time, I was like, I don't have any resources. I'm me myself. I'm trying to figure this thing out. But then I realized, I was like, I have a voice. I can advocate. I can speak up. And so then I wrote a song about it. And that just took off and introduced me to different organizations who are doing things. And so one of the things that I've been intentionally trying to do is create a space specifically for fathers, but, you know, Black fathers who are wrestling with the diagnoses, who are wrestling with parenting kids on the spectrum, who are wrestling with remaining married in a situation like this, because there's not a lot of spaces for us to have conversations and to really just tell the truth about where we are. You know, so you know what? This sucks. I'm upset because I won't be able to live vicariously through my son, because all fathers live vicariously through their kids. You know what I'm saying? And so it's like, I probably won't be able to do that. And so now I have to find new victories. I have to find new joys. And it's just about trying to reset those expectations in a way that keeps them involved in their families, teaches them how to love differently and how to figure out how to experience love differently, because your kids may not be able to say I love you. They may demonstrate it differently. My sons don't voluntarily come up and say I love you, but the way he's always hovering, or the way that my kids are always hovering around me, just that to me is like, oh, they love me, they appreciate me, you know. And so there's things like this that fathers need to hear and need to and then there's the, you know, other things like resources, man. How do you deal with, you know, my kid's about to turn 18. So now there's a lot of questions about guardianship. It's like, and there are people who like, hey, I don't know what to do. You know, how do I navigate that? So it's just, it's so much. And so I want to be able to create an environment, a community locally, but then also globally, of folks who can say, I want to descend somewhere and get information that may be helpful for me. And if I can be that, man, well then, Lord willing, there's that need, right? I'm not particularly skilled at it, but there's a need there. And so, and there's a sense of suffering there as well. And like, I will forever have to deal or live, deal is not the right word. I will ever, forever have to live with this condition that is, that my sons have, you know, and it's teaching me the beauty of who they are, but it's also created some struggle in my life and in their lives as well. And so we're learning how to cultivate, if you will, together as a family.
Yeah, that's so well said, so honest too. I mean, even as you're sharing, I know you talked about the suffering, but it's also obvious that there's a lot of joy there too, as you talk about the ways that they express their love to you. So, I mean, I know that that's important, and I think it's also helpful, even as you accidentally stepped into this advocacy role, for others to hear from you too, from your vantage point, because there is such an important part of community that happens, and with you having that platform, being able to kind of create that community in a sense as well.
And if I can, I want to shout out one organization that I think is just wonderful. It's an organization called Culture City that does a lot of great advocacy. So if there are people here who have restaurants, who have, you know, organizations, and you're trying to figure out how do I make my space more sensory inclusive, I would say reach out to Culture City, culture with a K and then city.org, and they will definitely help you do that.
That's awesome. I appreciate you mentioned that, and we can even drop, you know, some of that show notes and give people links and things like that as well. So wow, well, we covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, man.
I appreciate you just kind of
I'm glad you gave that disclaimer at the beginning, because
that is the way it is. But I mean, to be honest, I think that's some of what people appreciate about this podcast too. That it's not structured and locked into one lane or one venue, but I think appropriately pulling in these different pieces without getting too wide and outside of our area of experience or expertise, but just being able to be real about these things too, because I think there's so much that can come from these conversations, and hopefully it sparks conversations for other folks as well. But appreciate your insights, your honesty, all that you've been doing over the years that you continue to do, and just for taking the time out to even be on this podcast.
I mean, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I can actually say that I've been to Yale now.
You can.
I've been to Yale. I've spoken at Yale. Yeah.
Yeah, Yale Broadcast Studio Production. So I think we can give you that. All right. Thanks again for joining.
Thank you.